Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. This week, we hear reports from Alice Bryant and Pete Musto. We close the show with an American story. But first, Ana Mateo and I have the last part of our five-part series, The Worth of a Girl. A few years ago, a gas explosion destroyed Katie Burns' house in the state of Tennessee. Her wedding pictures, which showed the 16-year-old bride, were gone. She wore a shirt and jeans rather than a wedding dress. There were no flowers. She was marrying Ben Burns, who was 30 years old. A few years after the wedding, Katie still has no physical proof of her marriage to Ben because, she said, my sister stole my wedding ring. To the United Nations and the U.S. State Department, Katie is a victim of human rights abuse. But what she did was legal and not uncommon in the Midwestern state of Missouri, where the marriage took place. Katie's hometown of Dyersburg is along the Tennessee border with Missouri. More than 78,000 children in the United States are or have been married, says a new report by the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. Missouri was, at that time, a common place for child marriages because the state has no minimum age requirement. Children younger than 14 needed a judge's approval. Last year, the state raised the lowest lawful marriage age to 16. Tennessee still does not permit 16-year-olds to marry. Katie's mother, Evelyn Montgomery, says she permitted the marriage only because Katie was pregnant with Ben's child. Since Katie was younger than 18, Ben could have been charged with statutory rape of a minor. I told my mom, what am I going to do with a baby? And he's in jail, and I have no job, Katie explained. To Evelyn, marriage was not the best solution. But I felt at the time it was the only option, she said. Katie and Ben have been married 8 years now. I don't care what anybody thinks. I love him, Katie declared. It is what it is. Katie jokingly admits her husband is almost as old as her father. And she is only 5 years older than her son from Ben's former marriage. They all live together in a yellow house next to the railroad.
15-year-old Ashley Duncan was in her first year of high school in rural Steele, Missouri. She was sitting on a school bus when her aunt told her, "Get off, Ashley. You're getting married today." Like Burns, she was pregnant. But she did not want to marry the 18-year-old father. When the preacher was talking, and I'm supposed to say I do, I said, I guess, Ashley remembers. Neither she nor her husband finished high school. They fought a lot. Then they separated. When you're young, you tend to believe people when they say they love you, and you tend to listen to people when they tell you to do things, she said. Ashley loves her two sons, ages 8 and 9, and is raising them along with her boyfriend's two sons, ages 5 and 6. She has been separated from her husband for years. But, she says, it costs too much to get a legal end to the marriage. Ashley wishes someone would have warned her about the possible results of underage marriage. Now I feel like I wasted so much of my life, and it really didn't have to happen, she said. Both girls lost their childhoods. Katie says she misses playing softball and not having a care in the world. Ashley misses sleepovers with her friends. After I got married, she said, friends didn't really come around anymore.
Both Katie and Ashley were married at the Pemiscot County Courthouse in Caruthersville, Missouri, a city of fewer than 7,000 people. Caruthersville is in an area of southern Missouri called the Boot Heel because of its shape. The Boot Heel, one of the poorer parts of Missouri, borders on three states, making it a popular place for child weddings. Before a 2018 law on marriage age, Missouri placed no conditions on 15-year-olds getting married. And a judge could permit children younger than that to be married. Now, if one person is younger than 18 and their partner is 21 or older, the state will not issue them permission to marry. Katie and Ben Burns have a house filled with dogs, cats, and even a pot-bellied pig. The couple's spirited daughter, Zena, is now in first grade. However, the Burnses do not dream of early marriage for Zena. I should have waited, Katie says. You really do need to be 18, in my opinion. You need to be grown up.
One in four people around the world is at risk of facing dangerous water shortages, an American research organization warned Tuesday. India is at the highest risk. 17 countries face extremely high water stress because they use 80% of their available water each year. The situation is made worse by a rise in dry periods linked to climate change, the World Resources Institute, or WRI, said. We're currently facing a global water crisis, said Betsy Otto, director of WRI's Global Water Program. New information from WRI's Aqueduct Water Risk Atlas showed the countries suffering most are in and around the Middle East and North Africa. The WRI Atlas is a risk mapping tool that helps governments, companies, investors, and other users understand where and how water risks arise worldwide. Qatar is the most water-stressed country, followed by Israel and Lebanon. India is 13th among extremely high water-stressed nations. But with a population of more than 1.3 billion, it has more than three times the people in the other 16 countries combined. In those countries, agriculture, industry, and cities depend on avoiding water bankruptcy. Water bankruptcy means there is no possibility of full recovery from water shortages. India's sixth largest city, Chennai, was the latest city worldwide to warn it could be without water as water storage levels fell. That followed similar announcements from South Africa's Cape Town last year and Brazil's São Paulo in 2015. We're likely to see more of these kinds of day zeros in the future, said Otto. Many things threaten the world's water supplies, from climate change to poor supervision, WRI said. High dependence on groundwater supplies, which are decreasing, is an added concern, Paul Raig told reporters. He leads work on the Aqueduct Water Risk Atlas. Raig noted groundwater supplies are difficult to measure and manage because they are deep below the Earth's surface. Nearly a third of the world's fresh water is groundwater. That information comes from the U.S. Geological Survey, a government agency. Because we don't understand groundwater and don't see it, we manage it very poorly, Raig said. WRI's Atlas listed 189 countries in order of water stress, drought, and river flood risk. The organization worked with universities and research organizations in the Netherlands and Switzerland using information from the 1960s to 2014. I'm Alice Bryant.
This week, we answer a question from Midard Luck. Midard writes, give the difference between to tell and to say. Dear Midard, to tell and to say both describe a person communicating with others. To understand the difference between the two, consider the words right after tell and say. In general, the word right after tell describes whom the speaker is talking to. The words right after say describe what the speaker is saying. Let us look at tell first. Imagine you have a plan that you do not want anyone else to know. When your parents ask you what you are doing tonight, you tell them a lie. But later, you tell your sister your secret. In these examples, the listeners are them and your sister. They are identified right after the word tell. It would not be correct to write, you say your parents a lie, or you say your sister a secret. If you want to use the word say correctly, try writing the information the speaker is communicating. For example, when you talk to your sister, you say that you are leaving the house after dark. You add, don't say anything to mom and dad. Here, say is followed by the words that and anything. These words commonly follow the word say along with where, when, something, and to. Lines of dialogue also often come after say. Here are some other examples to help you practice. Imagine that one day after work, you meet some friends for a meal. When your first friend arrives at the restaurant, she is very unhappy. Tell me what is wrong, you urge. She says, my coworker told me I talk too loudly. He says to be more quiet. You answer, that wasn't very nice. Say where I can meet him and I will talk to him. A little later, another friend joins you at the restaurant. He tells you how happy he is, so you ask why. He says, I took the bus here and the payment machine was broken, so the driver said, all rides are free. He told you that? you answer, "That was nice of him." Then a third friend arrives at the restaurant. She says that she has some very big news. "Just say when you are ready to hear it," she jokes. "Tell us," the group shouts. She says, "I'm 6 months pregnant." "6 months," you answer. "Why didn't you say something sooner?" She says, "I wanted to tell you all at the same time. I was waiting for us to get together." Do you see the pattern? Tell is almost always followed by a word identifying the listener. And say is almost always followed by the words the speaker is saying. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Pete Musto.
Today, we continue the story, Benito Sereno. It was written by Herman Melville. Last week, we told how African slaves on a Spanish ship rebelled in 1799. They killed most of the Spanish sailors. Now, here is Shep O'Neill to continue our story.
As Captain Delano came up in his whaleboat, he saw that the other ship needed scraping, tarring, and brushing. It looked old and decayed. He climbed up the side and came aboard. He was quickly surrounded by a crowd of black men. Captain Delano looked around for the man who commanded the ship. The Spanish captain stood a little way off, against the main mast. He was young-looking, richly dressed, but seemed troubled and tired with the spirit gone out of him. He looked unhappily toward his American visitor. At the Spanish captain's side stood a small black man with a rough face. Captain Delano struggled forward through the crowd, went up to the Spaniard, and greeted him. He offered to help him in any way he could. Captain Benito Sereno returned the American's greeting politely, but without warmth. Captain Delano pushed his way back through the crowd to the gangway. He told his men to go and bring back as much water as they could. Also bread, pumpkins, sugar, and a dozen of his private bottles of cider. The whaleboat pushed off. Left alone, Captain Delano again observed with fresh surprise the general disorder aboard the ship. Some of the men were fighting. There were no deck officers to discipline or control the violent ones, and everyone seemed to do as he pleased. Captain Delano could not fully understand how this could have happened. What could explain such a breakdown of order and responsibility? He asked Don Benito to give him the full story of his ship's misfortunes. Don Benito did not answer. He just kept looking at his American visitor as if he heard nothing. This angered Captain Delano, who suddenly turned away and walked forward to one of the Spanish seamen for his answer. But he had hardly gone 5 steps when Don Benito called him back. "It is now 190 days," Don Benito began, "that the ship sailed from Buenos Aires for Lima with a general cargo. Pedigree, tea, and the like, and a number of Negroes, now not more than 150, as you see, but then numbering over 300 souls. The ship was officered and well manned, with several cabin passengers, some 50 Spaniards in all. Off Cape Horn we had heavy gales. Captain Sereno coughed suddenly and almost collapsed. He fell heavily against his body servant. "His mind wanders," said Babo. "He was thinking of the disease that followed the gales, my poor, poor master." "Be patient, senor. These attacks do not last long. Master will soon be himself." Don Benito recovered, and in a broken voice continued his story. "My ship was tossed about many days in storms off Cape Horn, and then there was an outbreak of scurvy. The disease carried off many whites and blacks. Most of my surviving seamen had become so sick that they could not handle the sails well. For days and nights we could not control the ship. It was blown northwestward. The wind suddenly left us in unknown waters with oppressive hot calms. Most of our water was gone. And we suffered terribly, especially after a deadly fever broke out among us. Whole families of blacks and many Spaniards, including every officer but myself, were killed by the disease." Don Benito paused. He looked down at the black man at his side. Babo seemed satisfied. The Spanish captain saw him take his hand from the knife hidden under his shirt. Captain Delano saw nothing. His mind was filled with the terrible tale he had just heard. Now he could understand why the other captain seemed so shaken. He took Don Benito's hand and promised to give him all the help possible. He would give him a large, permanent supply of water and some sails and equipment for sailing the ship. And he also promised to let Don Benito have 3 of his best seamen for temporary deck officers. In this way, the San Dominique could, without delay, start for Concepcion. There, the ship could be fixed and prepared for its voyage to Lima. Don Benito's face lighted up. He seemed excited by Captain Delano's generous offer, but Babo appeared troubled. "This excitement is bad for Master," Babo whispered, taking Don Benito's arm and with soothing words gently drawing him aside. When Don Benito returned, Captain Delano observed that his excitement was gone. Captain Delano decided to talk of other matters, but the Spanish captain showed no further interest. He answered Captain Delano's questions with sharp words, and suddenly, with an angry movement, he walked back to Babo. Captain Delano watched the two men whispering together in low voices. It made an ugly picture, which Captain Delano found so extremely unpleasant that he turned his face to the other side of the ship. Their actions made Delano suspicious of Captain Sereno. He began to wonder about him, his behavior, his coughing attacks, his weakness, his empty, wild looks. Was he really half mad, or a faker playing a part? One moment, Captain Delano had the worst suspicions of Don Benito, but the next, he felt guilty and ashamed of himself for having such doubts about the man. Presently, Don Benito moved back toward his guest, still supported by his servant. His pale face twitched. He seemed more nervous than usual, and there was a strange tone in his husky whisper as he spoke. "May I ask how many men you have on board, senor?" Captain Delano became uneasy, but answered, "About 25 all total." "And at present, senor, all on board?" "All on board," Captain Delano answered. "And will be tonight, senor?" At this last question, Captain Delano looked very seriously at Don Benito, who could not return the look, but dropped his eyes to the deck. Captain Delano could think of only one reason for such a question, but no, it was foolish to think that these weak and starving men could have any idea of seizing his ship. But still, he remained silent. "And will they be aboard tonight?" Again, the question from Don Benito. Captain Delano decided to answer truthfully. Some of his men had talked of going off on a fishing party about midnight, and he told Don Benito this. As he answered, Captain Delano again looked straight at Don Benito, but the Spanish captain refused to meet his eyes. Then, as before, he suddenly withdrew with his servant, and again the two men began whispering to each other in low voices. Captain Delano tried to push the worry from his mind, but what were those two strange men discussing? That will be our story next week.
You have been listening to the VOA program, American Stories. Your narrator was Shep O'Neill. We invite you to listen again next week for the final part of Benito Sereno by Herman Melville. I'm Jim Tedder.
That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.